All right, welcome back to Structured Insights, the podcast where we take tech hype, strip it down to the stuff that really matters, and make sense of it all for all of you listening and watching. Today, we are super excited. We've got some, as always, some really smart people, and we're going to be diving into the world of Microsoft. We're not going to just start on the surface. We're going to go a little bit deeper today, and because we're doing that, we have two heavy hitters. We have, obviously, the regular on this podcast, Mr. Bill Tracy. Welcome back, Bill.
Welcome back to the pod, everybody, and great job on starting off with a Microsoft Surface pun, Nick.
We also have Structured's very own Microsoft guru and VP of Cloud Architecture, Chris McDuffie. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
All right. So you guys obviously live and breathe this stuff. You have, you know, you're working with customers, you're seeing IT plans. We're going to dig in today around the things that, you know, from compliance to cloud to Copilot to all these things. And I think it's really important. Obviously, Microsoft's been in the news a lot lately, and it's becoming more and more important. But I want to really start, Chris, with the reality check. What is the most misunderstood thing about Microsoft's cloud landscape? Is it compliance? Is it licensing? Or is it like, hey, I'm the customer, and I actually have no idea what the heck I just bought?
I'd say the first and the last one there. The understanding what you bought and how to apply it, I think, goes direct hand in hand with the licensing piece. Licensing is, it feels intentionally obscure. It feels intentionally challenging.
And on Microsoft's part?
It does. And you know, it's, you could argue that some of this is done on purpose. But if you think about the development lifecycle, when somebody's creating a feature, you know, they're just trying to figure out what that feature is. They don't necessarily know where it's going to land within the organization. And so compliance to that feature, saying whether that feature should or shouldn't be allowed to a particular user, is kind of last in the mind of the development team. So when that feature lands, whatever suite it lands in, typically it does not have a gate on that feature to say whether users can or can't use that feature. So that becomes probably one of the single biggest pieces that drives confusion within the landscape. And it covers both the licensing side, and it covers that what do I have side and what can I use side. Because as people try to mix and match licensing within their tenant, they don't know whether they're compliant or not. They don't know whether they have the right tool set or not, and they don't know how to deploy what they have within their tenant. And so that really ends up kind of starting the conversation through the whole thing.
So not to pick on Microsoft, but I mean, it sounds like just their own sales structure of how you buy this, is that complicating the process for an enterprise?
It isn't. I mean, if you're buying direct, yeah, there you have to learn everything yourself. And quite frankly, you know, I've found most organizations, I'm going to say probably close to 90% of the organizations I work for are mislicensed in some way. They're either
over-licensed.
It's a huge number statement. It is. It's because the partner is not really helping the customer understand the context of those features and what they do and what the needs are there. Because Microsoft is, you know, I've been in the industry for a long time. So way back in the day, I learned this lesson the hard way through when I was at a domain registrar, where I had a lot of SQL servers that were public facing, and I was using a particular licensing program at the time. And so I tried to hide those servers behind an application box and say, I only need 5 licenses. Well, that was not Microsoft's idea of how things work. And so they developed this concept called multiplexing. So if you try to multiplex a license, meaning I try to put barriers in front of that license to reduce what I need on the back end, that's not going to stop them from saying that you need the additional licensing. Fast forward to today, and that concept is buried into as users receive benefit. So if a user receives a benefit through a certain license, that means they need to be licensed for that. And that context can come across virtually any feature. It's particularly in the compliance and security features where, for example, if you had eDiscovery and you turned eDiscovery on and you wanted to do eDiscovery against an individual, that individual has to have that eDiscovery license. It could be in security. If I turn on my tenant, Entra is a tenant-wide function, and you got to be super careful that whatever feature you deploy in Entra, if it's available to all of the users, then those users have to be licensed. And it's across the whole tenant. Many features are very much like that.
So let's zoom out a little bit before we jump back into the alphabet soup of some of this stuff. If you think about, as you referenced the past of Microsoft, and you think about the experience that it was and what Microsoft was to an enterprise, you know, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, to what it is now. Maybe let's set the context for how it's changed from what it was when you were trying to, you know, having hide behind the box, so to speak, to what it is now. Like, just let's give some context to the listeners of how's the Microsoft experience and the Microsoft, basically the applications changed over the last several years. Because I think you guys, I'm sure Bill would probably agree too. Like, I mean, the value is different than it was 5 years ago, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. The changes and, you know, it's across just the acquisition of it, the functions of it, everything within Microsoft moving to this cloud vision. I think Satya was brilliant in focusing on cloud so early on and moving the organization in that direction. Microsoft has become really a strategic, much more strategic. So they've always been that player. They've always been the infrastructure. They've always been that layer of the operating system and owning the desktop application suite. But the transition to becoming such a critical piece of anybody's infrastructure, you know, often when I go into an organization, this started early on in my career, trying to wrap my head around, you know, consulting and helping organizations. How do I codify, or how do I, you know, separate the different pieces to have that conversation, simplify them, and figure out what it means. And so I started just writing on the board when we'd have a conversation, applications, users, and data, and tying everything back to that. And as we look at where Microsoft has grown, I mean, if you look at Copilot, for example, Copilot actually fits two of those. Copilot is an application, and now it's actually a user. If you look at the agentic web, you have to provide identities and secure those identities of those agents as they work to, as an application, to increase the value of the organization through the data set that they have. So,
all right, well, so you opened up the door for Copilot, you opened up the door for AI. All right. I got to step through it. So let's jump into Copilot then. Let's separate the buzz from the reality of what it is, right? So today, like, give it, what's the Copilot breakdown? Like what is what's now part of the free, got to pay? Is it an extra employee now? Does it save time in business process? Let's maybe try to break down what it is, because I do think there's a lot of misconceptions about it from just the businesses we talk to, that they think it's one thing. I think the reality is very different.
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's a free component of virtually everybody's system. So it usually in the context of a web search, so, or some kind of a question that I'm asking, then you get a response, and virtually every browser has some kind of an AI element to it. So there is a Copilot that does that. Where it starts to get paid in the organization is if you have an Entra ID license. An Entra ID is part of the Microsoft 365 suite. So if you have Office 365 suites, you don't necessarily have Entra, but if you have a Microsoft 365 suite, more than likely you have Entra in that. There are some exceptions to that rule that we could talk about, but if you have Entra ID, now you have the context of your organization as part of that search. So your tenant is secured. So any data that comes in that search does not go into the chat that you create. But then next up the scale, as you get to paid, That's when you start to get into licensing. And there's actually two different ways that you can license Copilot. One is you can license it per user, or you can license it per message. And so you can even do pay as you go as you want to. And it's typically around the agent model and building the agent model where you're paying for, you know, a certain number of messages. You could pay for 25,000 messages is like $240 a month, I think, is what it is. But
so let's go back a little bit though to, you brought up the intro, and I do want to, for context, as we, you know, as we're going wide and deep here, there's a lot of acronyms in Microsoft, right?
Yes.
There's Intra, there's CMMC, GCC, DRAS, like what are the key terms that they should know? Obviously that's why they need help from people like Structured, but also they need to educate themselves, right? And we'll get into Azure as well, but like, let's maybe just break down a few of the key acronyms and what do they mean?
Okay. So Entra ID used to be called Azure Active Directory. That was a Steve Ballmer naming convention, but I think it was actually, it was a brilliant naming convention because it tied the term Active Directory to it. So it gave people a context of, I have Active Directory on premises. This is Active Directory in the cloud. It isn't actually Active Directory in the cloud, but it gave people at least a context to understand what it is. So a couple of years ago, Microsoft renamed it to Entra ID. And the concept is this is your entry into the organization, but it is all about identity management. So it's their identity platform and identity security platform in cloud. So anything related to things like MFA, conditional access, looking at risk-based user behavior, things like that, that is in that Entra suite. And there are different levels with it, from free, you know, to higher paid ones. And they've thrown some other things in there, but really it's that identity platform.
So is that critical? Let's just be like, of the level of like, hey, this is super important, or it's a nice to have. Is that Entra suite must have?
So there is an Entra suite. The Entra suite is not critical, but Entra as a tool is super critical. Because that's your identity. So you have your on-prem infrastructure, you have your domain, you know, your name at whatever.com. In the Microsoft world, everything gets translated to a Microsoft domain. So the tenant in Microsoft is actually based on an on-microsoft.com domain. So when you look at, if you open up a document in SharePoint, you're going to see the subdomain that you chose, which may not be the same as your on-prem domain, .onmicrosoft.com. And it's the process of taking your Active Directory and then synchronizing that up to the cloud to synchronize between the on-Microsoft and the Active Directory. And then all of your security, Microsoft is moving pretty much all of security from on-prem into cloud. So even securing your on-prem infrastructure is now done in cloud. So all monies Microsoft is investing into both identity and security is all in cloud now.
So this is obviously, I mean, this could be a rhetorical question, but I have to ask it anyways. So why should the enterprise care? Because again, we know why Microsoft cares.
Right.
Why should the enterprise care?
Well, the enterprise needs to care because it is, again, it comes back to being such a huge part of the infrastructure of an organization. Organizations need a collaboration platform, but most organizations are still going to be running some kind of Windows OS, whether that's server or desktop. Then you've got, you know, the Microsoft can be the place where you store your documents or manage your documents, things like that. They've got the desktop applications to manage that. So it comes back to that applications, users, and data conversation, where they span the entire gamut of everything. So there really isn't another. I think Google is probably the closest player that could do some of those things. Like Google has the cloud, Google has the desktop applications and things that can store the data. So they're pretty similar, but you're looking at, you know, Chrome or Chrome OS. They don't have some of the foundational operating systems back end, some of the dev tool sets, things like that that Microsoft does. So they really span a much broader set to touch all of those areas than anybody else does. And we find...
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
We it's interesting because I see more and more organizations that are Google organizations that are actually coming to Microsoft specifically for Entra ID. So they'll they're either
really want to take that little snippet right there and just broadcast that everywhere, right?
Microsoft is a platform. So and I'm jumping all around here, but so if you look at Active Directory,
it's kind of like Microsoft though, they're everywhere. Yeah. This is not the same. We're just following how Microsoft works. They're everywhere.
If you look at old school Active Directory, so Active Directory had policy related to users and it had policy related to devices, and you joined all your servers, all your devices, everything to it. When you migrate to Microsoft 365, the identity piece goes to Entra, but the device piece has to land somewhere else. If you had SCCM, things like that, if you want to go cloud native, you're going to have to go to a different platform for your desktops. That's Intune in the Microsoft world. And then on the server platform, that's Azure Arc. Azure Arc can manage both stuff that's in cloud and it can manage the stuff that's on premises. So it's really broken into three different pieces. So when I see somebody coming from Google, they get sucked into that same kind of thing. They have to go to Entra and then they also go to Intune when it comes to they may have server management within the Google platform, but to manage their desktop devices as well as mobile devices and things like that, they're going to Intune. So I see that as actually a fairly common motion.
So you brought up Azure. So that's, I mean, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of commentary, a lot of, if you look on Reddit, you look on just people commenting across in the cybersecurity world and just tech world. I feel like, some people say like they look at it as just one thing, right? And it's just very blanket, like, hey, this is just Azure. I think obviously that's not the case based on where we've been discussing. So what are people getting wrong about how they see what Azure is?
I think the biggest thing people get wrong is they forget the last 30, 40 years. honestly,
it's not 30 or 40 years old.
but the thing is data centers are so ubiquitous. We don't even think about them. We don't think of the pieces in that data center that are critical pieces that, that have lived there forever. And none of us even think twice about them. And that can be, you know, some of it's within the layer of the hypervisor, some of it's the physical layer, some of, you know, there's lots of pieces there. So when somebody says, I want to migrate to cloud, they think it's a simple, you know, easy process of just, you know, going from here to here. And it's some of the tools that are out there. Okay, let's just do a simple DRaaS or something like that, where we're doing DR as a service to the cloud. And it's like, well, that's great. You packed up your house, maybe it's an apartment building, you packed it all up and you dropped it off into the storage unit. Where are you going to put it, you know, when you get out on the other side? You have to build out that house or that apartment building to mimic what you had on premises in order to be successful. And there's a lot of things that you probably need to do that you weren't doing on premises, you know, your processes and things like that, that because you were in your walled castle and you didn't have to think about it, you now have to think about those things when you move to cloud. And
so is the primary issue then they're pointing out, is it cost management or is it more design and architecture?
It's design and architecture. I mean, cost management and those things certainly come into play. But if you're moving to cloud, you're not moving to cloud necessarily to save money. You're moving to cloud for some kind of an initiative. I need to improve something. I need to improve speed. I need to improve my application. I need to modernize my application. There needs to be a business motive for you to move to cloud. So
without naming names, could you guys give us an example of that? Make it real for people.
I it's interesting. I don't know why, but the construction industry wants to move lots of stuff to the cloud.
Really?
Yeah, it's really interesting. But the challenge with moving the construction industry to the cloud is their application is actually data. In my mind, it's data because we have to look at the workflow. How are users interacting with their data and their application? Where do the data and applications sit? And how does the user interact and interface with those things? Data is critical to a construction organization, similar to like a design organization, because the files are generally very, very large. So where that data sits becomes really part of that entire strategy. I have to put my application or I have to put the user in the same place as where that data is to be successful. And if I'm doing that, sometimes that can be super beneficial. Like if my plan is I want to have an organization that is everywhere across the country, I want ubiquitous access to all this information and make it easy. I can put the desktop in the cloud next to my data, simplify that process. Everything is really easy. But if I want to just pick up my data center and move it there and have my users interact the same way that they did before, I have a huge file in the cloud. It costs a lot of money to move that file back out of the cloud for the user to use it. Then they send it back up and forth, and there's tremendous latency in moving that file back and forth on a frequent basis. So you have to find a methodology that works within the context of that organization's workflow, if that's really adding business value to do that. So we have to find ways to make that application fit the workflow to improve it. Or we have to redesign that workflow entirely to meet the needs of that organization. So it's a challenge to sit down and talk to somebody saying, I don't think it works the way that you think it works.
That totally speaks back to the architecture and design side of this, because again, exactly. I think of the construction, the architecture industry, even manufacturing in some cases. These are three areas where we're seeing customers have really aggressive cloud goals, because in like the construction side of it, these are highly mobile enterprises. You know, they need to go set, there's a trailers, buildings that go out to support a construction infrastructure project, and those move all over the country based on the project. And traditionally, the way they access that was within the walled garden, usually with remote desktop, Citrix type tools to get to that data. So it was very secure, and I controlled the network and the connectivity and the access to that data. And all those costs were controlled. The security was controlled. Moving it to the cloud absolutely makes that data more accessible. But to Chris's point, it's expensive to store data in the cloud and it's expensive to retrieve data from the cloud. But those users need that data locally where they're at on their systems at the end of the day to perform that job function. So when we think about taking that kind of client to the cloud, you're completely rethinking your network architecture, your security architecture, your access architecture. And in these specific industries like construction and architecture firms, for a good example, we're seeing tons of just call them global file system products and solutions come to market to serve their industry specifically. How can I more efficiently and more cost-effectively deliver those files on a global scale than traditional cloud architectures? But that doesn't meet that meets the user and the data need. And now my users just need to have good connectivity to the cloud and they can get their data. Problem solved. Still doesn't solve my application problem. That's now where maybe Azure comes in. And now I have this, you know, hybrid multi-cloud architecture. I've got users and devices on-prem. I've got this application called, you know, file services up in the cloud that's meeting that specific need, but I also still have critical applications that need to run both on those local devices and in an environment like Azure or some other cloud architecture. So how am I ensuring connectivity and security and scale across that entire enterprise? So again, it's back to super simple concept, but we just start drawing the picture and we've got now lots of squiggly lines, lots of now exposure points, you know, on the, call it the interwebs in the public world from a cybersecurity standpoint, and all these other considerations that are very transformational for the way that those industries have done it for 20 years. So we could architect and whiteboard this thing in 10 minutes for a customer nowadays. Right. That architecture conversation is now significantly longer. And I think I would say that that's when folks think about migrating to cloud. And there are vendors, we'll leave them unnamed, that are helping clients want to drive to the cloud even more aggressively now because of whether it be agility, sometimes even cost, other reasons. And so now you have more and more folks pushing that way that maybe haven't made that foray yet, but are being driven by the business. And that's where, you know, helping clients really take a step back and think about the architecture, the connectivity, and the ongoing ingress egress costs of cloud need to be a consideration in how they work.
If you think about this, I mean, does size and I guess volume and employee size, does that matter? Like, should a, if you think about who should be even considering this, is it, you know, an enterprise at this level? Is it an SMB? Is it, I got to be this big to be able to consider it? Like, where is there a cutoff?
There's no cutoff there. It's everyone. And because it's driven by the workflow, it's driven by the application, it's driven by where that data sits. So how am I interacting with those things? Where do I want to be? We have customers who are in the middle of modernizing. They might have 300 users. They're modernizing an application. They want to get it, you know, off-prem and into cloud. So, you know, it has driven their entire cloud journey based on a single application that they want to modernize in the organization. So it can be as simple as that. But I do see, it's interesting. I see smaller businesses tend to be the ones that are more reticent to move to cloud, particularly. I'm still going through O365 migrations. You'd be surprised at how many people still have on-premises Exchange servers and what percentage of those are under 200 users that still have an on-premises Exchange server. So they're doing all of that work, but the fear of getting into, you know, having that recurring cost, I think enterprises are less concerned about that ongoing subscription cost than some of the small businesses are, but it does go across all organizations.
The enterprise, exactly, Chris, does not have the cost aversion to moving to cloud. They have an infrastructure and application complexity problem that usually, you know, limits how fast they can make that transition, because it's at that point it's really time, cost, and people to make that transition. On the other hand, the small business is they've ran it a certain way, and their costs are usually much more fixed, and they're not as open to what's this ongoing recurring OPEX spend going to look like. The funny thing is, what we also see is the 10-person law firm has just as much complexity moving to the cloud, accessing those files, making the users happy in their workflow, as the 3,000 person construction firm or architecture firm. The challenges really aren't that different at the end of the day.
Obviously, Microsoft and licensing, lots going on in this area. And from what we understand, there's some changes in this space where, you know, the move from negotiation to automation. And I think it's really important for people to understand, what does that mean? Like, what does that actually mean going forward for their business and, you know, their budgets?
Yeah, I think the traditional negotiation cycle is going away, where people would do a 3-year negotiation with Microsoft on their enterprise agreement. For most organizations, that's going to transition to something else. Microsoft wants to get out of the business of manual and move to an automated sort of methodology, both for licensing and for the agreements. And as part of that, a lot of the support that came with enterprise agreements is going away. So it's even more critical now. EA providers, the ones who transact those licenses, are not getting compensated by Microsoft to do licensing support. So that is evolving into more of a managed service, or it's evolving into moving them to a different type of license methodology. And a CSP agreement, part of that advisory services is bundled with that. So that's the landscape change for clients to look at. They're no longer going to be getting the support from a partner on what to buy, how to buy, when to buy, those kinds of things through the EA agreement. They're being kind of pushed off of the traditional negotiation process and sort of pushed into working directly with a partner. So it's really critical that they find a partner that understands the licensing, the processing, and their business in order to help guide them down the right path when it comes to Microsoft licensing, because that world is changing. It started January 25. It's probably going to take 3 to 5 years. But over the next 3 to 5 years, people are going to see a dramatic change in the way that they acquire Microsoft licensing.
And Chris, this heavily affects users, you know, or organizations under about 2,500 users. Is that right?
Exactly. So Microsoft stratifies things. So there's level A through D. The level A's are the first ones to really kind of get the boot, particularly anybody at 1,000, 1,500 seats. It's going to be very difficult. I've heard it. It's 10 no's. They have to ask Microsoft, can I renew? And after 10 no's, Microsoft might help, but they really want to cycle people off that. And it's there are practical reasons for it too. If you purchase Microsoft in the last 2 weeks of their fiscal year, you're more likely to get a big discount. So somewhere in the neighborhood of some gargantuan 40 to 60% of final transactions for EA agreements were happening in the last 2 weeks of Microsoft's fiscal year, which just made it very difficult for them to process those kinds of things. So there's a selfish part of it on their part to try to automate things, but it is an ancient process which required people emailing spreadsheets and documents and things back and forth in the organization, and it was slow and cumbersome. So I think streamlining it.
So the bottom line is, if you want a secure landing zone, you know, pun intended, then you need to get help, right? Yep. Get some help in this process.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. All right, guys. So one last question, or just a if you stay to the end, a little bonus reel extra for you guys. So Copilot, obviously another AI tool. Obviously, more than that, Microsoft would be upset if I just said it that way. But what is the coolest thing you guys have done with Copilot these days that helps your day-to-day or even helps your household?
I think from my perspective, I use Copilot frequently as my memory or as the quick assistant. It's like over my shoulder, hey, do you remember who the salesperson is for this thing? It's really effective in that way. But as far as just silly things, I did a conference in Meridian, Idaho, and in the middle of the conference, I was demoing Copilot, and I just said, create a travel PowerPoint for Meridian, Idaho, live while we were doing the demo, and it came up with actually some pretty great stuff ready to go, just to hand over to the city in order to post on their website.
That's a good use case. How about you, Bill?
Well, I've got two. One's not a use case. It's more that Copilot and I are odds because it constantly just tells me that I'm too mean in my emails. And so we right now Copilot and I have a disagreement in tone. So I'm working through that, but maybe it'll make me a nicer person. I did use Copilot. I don't typically, when I do speeches, presentations, I never prepare. I rarely even use speaker notes, and my mom was retiring and we were hosting it. So I had to give a speech. And, I use Copilot to help write my mom's retirement speech. So now I'm outing myself to the world because I got so many good reviews on how good my speech was. And now anybody in my friends or family listen to this are going to know that, Copilot helped me write it.
That's a great example. I've used it for, I set up news feeds. Like I'll set it up to go ahead and send me specific topics, you know, in technology or whatever. And so it constantly every day sends me headlines of what's happening and just summarizing that. So I think it is, I mean, obviously across AI tools, I mean, there's 1,000 different ways to do it. And I think it's just fun. It's fun to keep pushing it. And I think I look at you made the point, Chris, about it's your memory. I think Copilot and any of these tools, right, they're like a teammate, right? They're not a tool. Yeah. They're actually just another resource, right?
Yep.
So cool. All right, guys, we'll have fun. Thanks again. And we will talk soon.